Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, and Dhamma talk that introduces the sixth week's study of the concentration factors of the path. This was recorded on January 21st, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So last week you studied the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, and I'd like to hear how that study went, if you have any questions. And in particular, how the being mindful of right speech, action, and livelihood contributes to developing an understanding of the Dhamma, but most specifically to gain the ability to recognize craving and clinging. And now that I put you on the spot, start with Jen.
So I read the chapter, it was my second or third time through, and I read about how, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but it was something like, there's some subtleties of right, you know, initially when you see right speech in your life, it's very eye-opening and very enlightening, so to speak. But as you continue to use it, there's some subtle things that come up or that you notice, and that was that part I understood this time, because I know that if I'm around people who are using right speech, I feel within myself a certain kind of restraint. Might be a little uncomfortable, but I feel like I'm in the position where I should be using right speech. Yeah. Likewise, you know, I'm curious that maybe other people are experiencing that if I'm using right speech, you know, because I notice that I don't hear gossip anymore, because especially in groups, like, you know, in the faculty room, sometimes I feel like when I walk in there, everybody just you know, is quiet, and I'm not an administrator, I'm not a boss, you know, it's just people just, and I don't feel like I'm preaching or anything. I just thought, so that was interesting.
Yeah.
Action and livelihood, I still feel very, that feels more remote to me. And I would say that, you know, the first three factors I feel really solid about, but then after that, definitely, like, it feels more remote. Although I have noticed that, you know, I some things that I used to do in my life, I just don't do anymore.
They just fell away.
They kind of fell away, yeah. But I don't, you know, I can use it, when you just said now, I can use it to notice craving, clinging, action, and livelihood, but it's like, I know that I should not be eating this right now because I am not hungry and I have no. And I'm like, and I know this is the wrong action, but I'm doing it anyway.
But that's the beginning of changing that. You first have to recognize it.
Right.
It's a long phase.
I feel it is a really long phase.
And that's getting to the subtleties of it, too.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So you're describing developing the Dhamma perfectly. That's how it is for most of us. Those subtleties of right speech. When you say right speech anyway, the first thing they'll say is, well, you got to be honest. You know, that's kind of an obvious one. We shouldn't say things that are hurtful to people. That's kind of obvious. And maybe we'll stop there. And that's okay. That's the beginning. That's the entry point to developing this. And, of course, that's an aspect of right action and right livelihood. We understand the subtleties there, too. But as we develop an understanding of that gross right speech, then we start recognizing the more subtle aspects. You could say the primary directive that the Buddha gave is to refrain from killing. I mean, that's the big one, right? But most of us aren't engaged in killing other people. But when we start getting an understanding of the subtleties of our speech, we recognize that we're using our speech for a type of character assassination. And that's really the more important aspect of it because it's so deep. We think it's okay. We think we got a free ride there by saying so-and-so is this and so-and-so is that. And when we have another person to agree with us, or look what's going on in the world stage, a whole group of people to agree with our hurtful speech, then we think that's okay. Nobody's objecting to what I'm saying. It must be okay. But you touched on it. It's not that you told that room that you walked into that quiets down when you walk in that they better watch what they're saying. But simply by the way that you're carrying yourself has affected them in a very positive way. Even if they're uncomfortable with you, they recognize that you're not one that engages in hurtful speech. And so they don't want to do it. It speaks directly to what the Buddha said consistently throughout his teaching. Look closely at your associations. Krishnamurti said it too in almost every talk he ever gave. Look at the life you're living. Look at who we're associating with. Because if we're associating with people that are prone to wrong speech, we're going to have a very difficult time recognizing it even in ourselves unless we're inclined toward it. Because there's that conditioning aspect where everybody else is doing it. But as we begin to change, we can then have that effect without even a direct approach, just by the way that we carry ourselves. So, like, you walk into the room and people start quieting down for the same. When you read the accounts of the Buddha walking into a certain situation, the same thing happened. Even if they didn't know him because of the way he carried himself.
Okay, my ego's taken off. Okay.
Well, so what I'm saying is you are acting, and not to feed you, but you are acting very Buddha-like in the fact that you're developing the path the way it should be, the path that he taught. And that's exactly how it works. Lauren and I were talking a little earlier today about these subtle aspects of recognizing self-referential views.
Right.
And it's all part of that. You know, as you start recognizing the subtle aspects of speech that you once thought was okay, or at least was didn't have any impact, and you realize that it does, it's the same thing as recognizing these very subtle levels of self-referential views. You know, one of the reasons why I say we need to be very gentle with ourselves is precisely that, because then we can start judging ourselves harshly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, look, I've done all this work, but I still say things like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to be recognized. That's all. You know, these are all common things. The Buddha taught this path for human beings to recognize the things that they've incorporated into their own lives that block lasting peace and happiness for themselves. And so the only people, even though we may be hurting other people by our actions in some ways, it's ultimately up to us to stop hurting ourselves by it. And by doing that, it's the most compassionate thing we can do, because then we can carry ourselves in a way that has such a profound effect on everyone else around us. You know, and that's really how it works. So thank you for bringing it up, little Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Becky, good to see you this morning.
Hi, nice to be here. Well, I read the chapter as well, and I still feel like I have right intention. I know that's the last chapter.
That's okay.
And I feel like I'm a little bit okay with right view, because I really want sounds ego-y, but I really want to be able to do this. I just, when I meditate, I can finally come to a point where I feel like my mind is calm. I feel like my stress level has gone down. And if it's a really good meditation, I can carry that through the day. But I'm not sure that I can't seem to go with that feeling, go beyond that into actually knowing if I'm practicing right speech, or, you know, because I can't stop and think every time I just can't get it to flow And I'm not being hard on myself, but I feel like I just have to do more study to be able. There's times when when I've wanted to really be able to communicate in a way that made, that was non-ego, and I have a hard time figuring out how to do that. In meditating, when my thoughts go off, I can just, I have that come back to my breath.
Yep.
But for right speech, I don't seem to have a, there's nothing to grab onto for me yet. And maybe that will eventually come, or, you know, I'll see that. But as of now, I'm still struggling with that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
And what's happening in the world has been probably more stressful to me this week than, it's a bigger stress than I've had in my life for a long time. And I haven't really been able to keep my mind calm because of it. I feel like, you know, I just
want can't
to do
not react.
Yep. I don't know what to do.
You might have had a teacher many years ago. His name was Arnold Patton. He's still out there cooking. He wasn't a Buddhist teacher, but a lot of the things that he taught were very close to what the Buddha taught. Anyway, he used to say, if you have this really strong desire to get up and do something, sit down. Stop. Because that's not the time to act. Just sit down. Stop. And then a lot of his teaching was to then put yourself in a, I won't use his words, in a frame of reference where you are at peace before you start to try to do anything. And that's pretty good advice. But
what Jen said about being able to actually get to the point where she felt like she had an impact on people without even having
okay,
an impact.
Compare yourself.
Well, but I was going to tell Jen. I was going
to
ask Jen.
I just want to say to you that really helped me.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That helped me with the world stress because I thought, well, that's what you do.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
That's all you
do. You take care of yourself first. Yeah. And you.
Yes.
And that's what you do. And then things will follow.
Yep. The current events that are leading people to a very stressful place, in the proper context, are seen as the first noble truth. There's a disappointing, unsatisfactory nature to life. It's part of life. It's not that it shouldn't be any different. It can't be any different, if you believe what the Buddha recognized. But I was going to ask Jen, do you want to respond to your mom?
Oh, I have like three things.
Well, so?
We're going to have coffee after, so. make it about her and I. But I think the last thing that you said, I'll just respond to that. The something to grab onto to be in right speech. Like how recognizing you're in wrong speech is the first step of moving into right speech, because that's what the Buddha says, recognize you're in wrong speech and go back to right speech. But how do you engage in right speech? My two rules are talk about what is happening right now in this moment, even if that means what your ego experience is, and put it in that context if you have to. Like, I feel frustrated. I am angry. I appreciate that those feelings are temporary, but that's how I'm feeling. Or help somebody else do that. Do not speak in a way that perpetuates your own ego or perpetuates somebody else's ego.
Yep.
And if that means you say nothing, you say nothing. Noble silence.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, that's beautiful. The right speech, action, and livelihood, all three can be characterized as being honest, being harmless, that what comes out of your mouth is necessary, meaning that it actually has some useful impact on the people you're talking to. And that doesn't. So standing out on the corner of Bridge and Harrison and me saying, follow the Buddha! That's a perfect example of unnecessary speech. In fact, it's even hurtful speech because it's going to turn people away who might possibly be inclined towards developing the Dhamma. So it sounds like a great idea, doesn't it? I'm going to save the world because I know better. That's unnecessary and it's often hurtful speech. And then just idle chatter, the things that we flap our gums about all the time that have no useful effect, recognize it and stop doing it. Sit quietly, it's okay. And the same thing has to do with action and livelihood. But what you're describing, Becky, is very similar to how Jen and most of us develop the Dhamma. You first get an intellectual understanding. So you even said that you've got a basic understanding of right view and right intention, and now you're starting to integrate right speech, action, and livelihood. And you're recognizing it in the proper framework. But you're also having difficulty in remembering off your cushion, well, wait a minute, I should be mindful of right speech. The reason why is you don't yet have that concentration that you can take off your cushion and bring it into your moment-by-moment life, because that's what's necessary. We need to have a certain measure of concentration off our cushions to recognize what's coming out of our mouth. You're at the beginning of that, but you have laid a very strong foundation to continue to deepen that practice. It's exactly how it's developing. It's exactly the reason why meditation is for deepening concentration, not for any other. It's okay to, people want to use meditation to have mystical experiences and travel around the cosmos in a disincarnate, whatever they might do, or to sit and visualize deities, which is another common form of meditation, or to just be focused on a mantra. All that's great, but it's not this practice. The reason why we use meditation to deepen concentration is to support the refined mindfulness, to hold in mind the other factors of the Eightfold Path, to be mindful of right view, and when engaged in wrong view, enter and remain in right view. To be mindful of wrong speech so that we can enter and remain in right speech. How can we do that if we don't have a well-concentrated mind? Yeah. That's why we use meditation the way we do it. And it develops exactly how you're describing it and your daughter's describing it, and most of us do. You know, it's a very simple and practical way. Lauren and I were talking again about this. When we start getting to the subtle aspects of it, we really are coming up against our conditioned reaction to not want to go that deep. We don't want to recognize right speech. So it creates a bit of a tension in our minds. And our minds want to go to more distraction. I don't want to look at this. Let me think of something else. Let me think about all the problems in the world today. And I don't have to deal with what's in front of me then. You know, it's very convenient that way. Why do people, I shouldn't say love it, but why do people, there's almost this worship of disaster and catastrophe and impending doom. We can't help but think about it. Well, the reason why is because it's such a perfect distraction to what's occurring right now. I don't have to deal with me. I can deal with all the problems in the world. Well, if you wanted, that's what the Buddha recognized too as the first noble truth. There is a common, disappointing, unsatisfactory, at times, utter suffering in the world. What can I do about it? The second noble truth is look at your own craving and clinging, because that's the only thing you can do about it. And imagine the world that was free of all individuals having craving and clinging, being driven by that, then we really would live in utopia, wouldn't it? I mean, there'd be no problems in the world, but it can only start at the individual level, you know, right here, right now.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Lisa, good morning. How are you? How's your study going? Nice to see you.
I read the chapter a couple times, and I reread some other parts to review, because it's enormous.
Yeah.
And I'm not an organized thinker or speaker. Usually my mind is just a jumble, and I kind of bounce around from one thing to another. So the virtues, you know, the words virtuous and also wisdom, they just seem like there are these ideas that are just in another dimension for me. I reread a couple paragraphs a couple times, but deepen concentration leads to an awareness of wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood. And, and there were a couple other sentences that just struck me. It's just they struck me, and it made me aware that I'm even wanting to do that. I feel it's you know, I've worked really hard for decades building something around myself, and I don't know whether it's a house of cards or whether it's brick and mortar. I don't know.
It's both.
That, and it's like, well, I'm sorry, but I'm perfectly happy being miserable.
Yep. Yeah, because it's so familiar. This is who I am. Yeah.
And from what was said before, I do tend to catastrophize things. I don't know if that's the right word. And it's so easy to get out of yourself and forget about your own. And I think that's actually my whole life. So seeing that, I am very, very resistant to changing.
Yeah.
But things are changing all the time. And not paying attention to myself, but looking out there at, you know, everything going on. And in some ways, though, there's something really difficult going on in our lives, and I thought, maybe this happened to come here, maybe just at the right time. Mm-hmm. Like, why did you just happen to come one Saturday? And you said, oh, I'm just happened to be starting this 10-week, you know. Why did that happen? Well, I don't know, random chance, but I thought, you know, maybe there's a reason. Maybe this will help me deal with this thing that's going on. But then if it can help with that, it can help with everything, anything. It can, but whether I'll let it or not, I don't know.
Yeah, that's up to you too. So that the opportunity to develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths are always there. I'm speaking to the timing in your life when you came to started coming here. But it's up to us as individuals to seize that opportunity. But the opportunity is always there. And it's been here ever since a human being awakened 2,600 years ago. It might seem, in fact, it probably will seem when we first encounter, I can remember the first time that I understood what the Buddha was actually teaching. And this was a long time ago. It can seem very significant because it is. But it's up to us to seize the opportunity and make the best of it. And so you are. You're, not that you are common, but you're describing the common human problem of conditioned thinking, which means we are naturally resistant to developing an understanding of reality. And so that one line that you mentioned, concentration, deepening concentration brings the ability to recognize wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood. We just talked about that. We never even realized it before. Even though at some level when we're engaged in hurtful speech, we recognize it even if we don't want to be aware of it. And a lot of times when I teach young children, the first thing I teach them is right speech, because they can relate, most of them can relate very quickly to the idea. I'll ask a young child, 9, 10, 12, when you're talking about your friends with another friend and you're not being very kind, how does it make you feel? And invariably the kid will say, oh, I don't feel so good. Well, that's the beginning of understanding that that's hurtful to yourself. It's not just that it's hurtful towards others. But you have to have a way, you have to have a frame of reference to recognize that. So it's obvious that engaging wrong speech, action, and livelihood is hurtful towards ourselves and others, but we don't even see it because it's so familiar to us. And that's not to say that we of wrong and right speech or wrong and right action or the other factors of the Eightfold Path. I'm able to start actively diminishing the effects of my ego personality. And that can be very uncomfortable at first, because like you said, this is who I am. I spent a long time getting here. I don't want to let it go. But what you're really letting go, the Buddha characterized what it seems so enormous, so difficult, is like foam on an ocean. There's nothing there to support it, except our own clinging and craving to views. Let go of the views. And again, one of the reasons why we need to be very gentle with ourselves is we're coming up against everything we think we are, everything we hold as dear that describes ourselves to ourselves. You're developing a Dhamma exactly as it should be, but it's not always pleasant. I used to say in class a lot that this is a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. You can take some determination. So.
Well, the other part of it, too, is the sitting, I'm just beginning to get an understanding of it. Because I've always meditated, but it's just been okay to try and relax and make your life a little bit better. And, you know, that meditation seems easy. It'll be a guided meditation, or I'll just put some music on or something and lie down. But doing this meditation for this is hard.
It's work.
Yeah.
Because
it
it's not just it. It's the sitting and clearing your mind is the door to your whole new life for yourself.
Yeah.
And that's really scary.
Yeah.
So when I sit there, why is 5 or 10 minutes seem like so long? Maybe it's just like, I don't know whether it's onerous or not. It's like knowing like that whole context of the Buddhism around it. It's not just it. You're clearing your mind so that you can, you know, have changed your life for the better.
Yeah.
And that's why the sitting is so hard. Like sitting is just a portal to, you know, to a whole other great life.
Yeah. It's one aspect of eight, one factor. One of the things I would say is it's best to let go of the idea that meditation is about clearing your mind, and it's just about deepening concentration. And I know it might be a subtle distinction, but when you recognize you're caught up in your thoughts, don't be concerned that that's not what you should be doing, because that is part of meditation. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And in the next moment, you might find that you're caught up in your thoughts again. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And if you're looking at meditation for deepening concentration, every time you recognize that you're caught up in your thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, you're deepening your concentration. If you're going into meditation with the attitude that I'm here to clear my mind, you're always going to be frustrated. But that's not what the purpose of it. I could teach this group a meditation method that very quickly you'll feel like you're in a trance-like state, that there's no thoughts, and it's a hurtful meditation. Why? Because it doesn't lead to insight and it doesn't lead to concentration. It's just substituting a technique for concentration. And the other thing you mentioned, and I'm not saying you should never use other meditation methods such as listening to music that quiet you, but if you think about the idea of laying and listening to beautiful music, no matter what it might be, whatever you think is beautiful music, even as you're deeply engaged with the music, you're not deepening your concentration. And the other thing that you're having a difficulty with, just the fact of just sitting and doing nothing else, is that a conditioned mind abhors boredom. And what's boredom is the need for distraction in this moment. I can't stand not having some kind of distraction. I need to be doing something. Well, that's the opposite or the antithesis of deepening concentration, isn't it? So go easy on yourself. Short periods of meditation. Don't try to go too far too fast. What I'm saying is, if you're meditating, say, I'm just a number, if you're meditating for 10 minutes and that feels uncomfortable, go back to 6 or 7 or 8 minutes until you feel comfortable with that. And then build on that. Don't try to go too far too fast. But everything you're describing is a meditation practice within this broader framework. You're coming up against a lot of your views, and you have some questions about what this is really going to entail. Be gentle with yourself and continue. Thank you for what you brought. Jay, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I delved into the book as best I could. It does confuse me, so I'll stick my nose in there for half a page and try and digest a bit of it. And I got to say that it's a little complicated, and you've indicated that it's a long-term thing, so I'm going to try not to fret about it. But
good.
One thing that came up yesterday, a bit of a conundrum for me, we have two daughters, one of whom is quite spiritual, meditates, is in a sangha in Center City, and somewhere along the line decided that both of us, me in particular, were some kind of beastly creatures and ogres and doesn't like the way we live and whatnot, decided she didn't really want to talk to us, so she hasn't been communicating. But yesterday, I had been sick during the week, we didn't tell her. She sent Lisa an email that she was upset that we hadn't told her. Well, she had told us she didn't want to hear from us, basically. So, since I was around the house rainy day, I got the iPad, and I emailed back and forth, and just told her very directly that, you know, better that we're all direct and straightforward, which is the way I like to tend to be. I don't want to dissemble. I don't want to tell her any bullshit or whatever. So I wound up in trouble with write email. We never got to speech. But we're going to have to add that. We're going to have to add that because I got in trouble. You know, I thought I was making headway with the daughter in Philadelphia, and so I was all excited. I told the daughter in San Diego, and when the daughter in Philadelphia found out I had told the daughter in San Diego, who she has issues with as well, she flipped out, and everything was in the toilet. So, and so, you know, things getting better and having some hope, all of a sudden, I was being honest, and I thought I was using right email, and it didn't work at all. Maybe I'd have been better to dissemble, oh, Jenny, we're so sorry to, you know, you're not feeling well, and we should have called you and that. But I said, if you don't, you know, basically, if you can't just come out and speak with us and say what's on your mind, what's the point? You're not really, at that point, you're not communicating.
Yeah, these are the most difficult relationships, obviously, within our family, you know, parents and children. In a general sense, as we develop the Dhamma, we realize that how other people act and portray themselves has nothing to do with us. In fact, we have no control over that. People that are acting in a confused way, I'm speaking in general terms, I don't know your daughters, are an aspect of the First Noble Truth. And they're acting that way because of the Second Noble Truth. In fact, you could say they're acting that way from a lack of understanding. When the Buddha awakened, he began with its ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of suffering in the world. So they're just acting from a point of view of not being fully engaged in reality. And so we can't even expect much of anything different, but we can learn to accept people as they are, especially our family, without the need to approve of them. So I'm sure both of you would like your at least that one daughter to be different. Okay, but you don't have to take that any further than I accept the fact that that's what I would prefer, without getting into I don't approve of that. You know, sure, it would be nice. When you first said that she's practicing Buddhist in Center City, I want to ask you, well, what tradition? But it's really none of my business, and it doesn't matter. But it's unfortunate that, in a general way, that she's not able to develop an understanding of this is how my parents are, and let them be at peace. You know?
Years ago, she did. When she got back from college, she was on my case big time, and then got into mindfulness and meditation, and kind of was what ready to accept me with warts and, you know, whatever.
Well,
things about my character that she didn't like or thought were wrong, and she kind of made a peace with that, and all of a sudden last year, I guess, she's just that has not applied. So I don't know what tradition she's in, what practice. I know she goes to retreats, she spends a lot of time on that, and I always told the kids my favorite philosophers were Popeye the Sailor, I Am What I Am, and Alfred E. Newman, What You Were. You know, but what do you do if you're trying to do? I guess you just have to keep your end up.
That's it.
As long as I'm being correct and not lying to her, or not dissembling, or not telling her some kind of borscht or something that I think she wants to hear. That's what I got to go with, I guess. You know, and like you say, you can't change people really. You know, you can show an example or hope that they come around, but you can't really, you know, reach into somebody's brain and mess with the switches. You know,
you can't. But as you continue to develop the Dhamma, you'll learn that difference between acceptance and approval. So you'll learn to accept her and everyone else just as they are, without the need for them to be any different. And that's the same as, that's the entire Dhamma too. We learn to accept ourselves in relation to the world exactly as it's occurring, as life unfolds, without the need to be any different. Why? Because it can't be any different. This is what's occurring. Also understand impermanence, and this is where we can gain a little bit of peace of mind, that everything changes. and your daughter may change in a certain way that allows for better communication. It may not. You know, I come from a big family. I can have an open discussion and communication with about half of them, and the other half think I'm they don't think very highly of me. And that's just the way it is. You know, years ago I tried to change it, but I don't anymore. It's just life. You know. Ultimately, what you develop an understanding of is that the only peace and happiness that you can develop directly is your own. But like Jen was talking about, through doing that, you have the opportunity to affect everyone around you, including your family. But it doesn't necessarily follow through. You know, so we like to think of ourselves as almost as saviors. And the reason why I'm saying that is everybody has a point of view that if other people would just think like I am, everything would be fine. That's a salvific point of view that if you look at it closely, you're saying, I'm God. I have the right way of thinking. Everybody should think like me. Everything would be fine. Well, it just doesn't make any sense, does it? It contradicts the first noble truth. And it contradicts all four noble truths. But we'd like to think that way, and especially as parents. We'd like to think if my children could just think correctly like me, and everything would be fine. But that's just not the case. It's just an unrealistic view. So we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We keep our minds at peace and at calm. We develop lasting peace and happiness for ourselves. And maybe we can affect other people that way, but maybe not. But at least we have it for ourselves. So thank you for bringing up it. It's a difficult situation. Becky?
And so it's possible then to just accept people as they are. Like if you have a family member who, you know, you just flat out don't like, it's possible through this practice to get to the point where you can accept them.
Oh, absolutely. Without the need to approve of them.
Without the need to approve of them.
Yep.
And that your lack of approval will stop getting in the way.
Sure. If the need to approve of someone else's behavior is no longer important to you, it's no longer an issue. In other words, you accept people as they are because that's how they are. It doesn't mean that you approve of it. It doesn't mean that you wouldn't hope that they would change in some way, whatever it might be, but this is what's in front of you. It's an aspect of understanding profoundly the first noble truth. It's one of the big problems in the world of seeing the point of view from a rational mind is that everybody should be peaceful and nonviolent with each other and looking out for each other. That's a great view, and it would be wonderful if the world is that way, but the truth is it's just not. So when we're stuck in the view of the world should be this way, we're creating intense amount of conflict within ourselves because the world isn't the way I want it to be. Rather than accepting there is going to be suffering in the world, what can I do about it? Well, one of the things that I can do about it is to keep myself as well concentrated and as mindful and as rooted in reality as I can be, because then I can be truly helpful when the need arises. But you cannot be helpful to anyone unless they want your help too. So again, it's a very difficult situation, especially with our families, but it's also true just throughout society. You know, people are going to be how they're going to be. There were people that came and listened to the Buddha talk. His own cousin, Devadatta, listened to the Buddha. He understood the efficacy of what his cousin was teaching him. And he tried to kill him twice. Twice he tried to kill him. Why? Out of greed. He wanted to be the spiritual guy in northern India. It's a great story. Maybe I'll teach it in a couple weeks about Devadatta. So caught up, so consumed with his own competitiveness and greed, that he tried to kill his cousin twice. And they, you know, think about that. This is the guy. This is the ultimate, he used the Christian term, the ultimate prince of peace. and his cousin couldn't wait to kill him. So there, it's a good example of, because the Buddha thought this way and acted in a totally integrated way, he still couldn't affect someone who was so confused and so deluded. You know,
yeah.
It's just the nature. But what did he do? What did the Buddha do? He went to the root of a tree or an empty hut and he sat for a little while. You know, that's all he could do.
I just wanted to say that I think recognizing it, so humans are always in relationship, so that's
mm-hmm.
always an opportunity for dukkha, because I have an identity and they have an identity, and if both people are not focused on kind of removing their identity from the situation, it's going to be difficult. And I just wanted to say that when you were talking about wanting someone to be different than who they are, or wanting them to behave in a different way, or wanting to convince them that they need to behave this way to be happy, ultimately that's really about they need to be different so that I can feel better.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's where your ego's in it. And that's,
yeah.
I don't know how to say that without, because
well, a self-referential ego self is very threatened by other egos that aren't in line with it,
with
the way it thinks.
It's not true. You don't need that person to be different to be happy yourself.
Yeah.
That's the realization that I think is.
And talking about subtle levels, it's because of how we create associations in our mind that other people that aren't in accordance with the way we think and act is such a challenge to us. Because we're associated with them. They need to be just like me, or there's something wrong with me. And if they're not like me, then there's something wrong with that. And it just gets into this crazy conflict. Another word for it is just this discursive thinking that you're bouncing off from egos. Instead of, this is who I am in this moment. That's who this is in this moment. And the next thought that doesn't have to be, and maybe they'll change. It's just, this is what's occurring. Period. This is what's occurring. And change will occur. Might be good, might be bad. Might be skillful or unskillful. Change will occur. You know? But what is the only thing that we ever have control over, if we want to, is the way we think. It's the only thing we can control. And how do we do it? We have to start with a well-concentrated mind. And then how do we develop that well-concentrated mind? We've been given a framework for how to develop it completely. An eightfold path. We gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. When we get a nasty call from a family member, we don't lose our minds over it because we've gained the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We understand where aberrant behavior comes from because we've looked at it in ourselves and we've solved that problem. It's why one of the things you hear me say often, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Why? Because now I understand other people's suffering. And I also understand that I can't change it. But I also understand the most important thing is I don't have to contribute to it anymore. The most profound thing that can happen to someone who is insistent on engaging you in their own insanity is to sit quietly. Because it's the best example you can give them. You don't have to engage in that. Oftentimes, the Buddha said there's four ways to respond to, and I won't get into the whole thing, there's four ways to respond to questions that are put, and he's meaning conflict, not just a direct question. And one of them is to sit quietly. And there's so many incidences throughout the Pali Canon where the Buddha is, someone's trying to engage the Buddha in conflict, and the Buddha just sits there. Because he understood there's no good that can possibly come out of engaging in the battle. The only thing I can do is be at peace. And spread that around a little bit. What a great talk. And it really directly relates to the virtuous factors, doesn't it? How do I act? What's the appropriate way to live in the world? You know, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Thank you. Eva, how are you this morning?
Thank you, John, for creating this wonderful environment.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
And it's very satisfying to be
here and hearing what everyone has to say. I learned so much from it all. I've read the book a few times, and I've jotted down notes, and then I'm going back to my notes, and I'm not understanding the notes, because it's whatever I understood then, it's not resonating now for some reason. And it's just so much information. I've really, really, at least twice have gone, you know, because we did, this is the second time, so the first time we went through it together, and then I tried to go, you know, over it myself and kind of read it all through. But it, there's just so much information that I can't absorb it all. And I guess just shows how profound that information, all this knowledge is. And I thank you again for the way that you explained it, because oftentimes as I'm reading, as I develop a question, then I go on to the next paragraph and you're answering that question, and that's very helpful. And then I go and I forget everything in the next moment. But yeah, I'm working on it, and it's really, it really is just really hard. And then Edith, the fact that you're here indicates that Jennifer has affected you in a way that you're not even probably aware of, and that's what we all want to be able to do in our, you know, in our environments with our friends and family and everything, to just maybe that silence will make a bigger impact than having said anything. You don't even know it, and it's just really deeply satisfying to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for what you said. You were speaking to what Jay was saying too before. It seems very complicated at first, and it's certainly not meant to be that way. But our minds have such a resistance to things that are. Once you understand anything, once you learn how to ride a bike, you know how to do it. Before, you couldn't. You know, you're going to kill yourself on it. Once you learn what this is about, it seems pretty obvious and pretty simple. But developing it, because we have a conditioned response to it, a reaction, a resistance to it, it seems very difficult. And the only thing we can do is to first develop this intellectual understanding. You go through the book. Every time you are able to be mindful of an aspect of the Eightfold Path, now you're being able to integrate it into your life. It's not something you sit down, you read. I mean, I guess you could read the book and, you know, if you were a quick reader, probably a couple hours. Mm. But you're not going to get much out of it. And you're not going to get much out of just listening to me or coming to class. There's a benefit to it. But it's only by integrating it. Ehepasiko, come and see for yourself, means you have to experience this. And it's as we experience it, and for most of us it's very gradual. We take one little bit of it and we integrate it into our lives. Okay, today I'm not going to gossip. I'm going to be mindful of it. And that seems like a Herculean task for many people, especially if you're prone to gossip. Very, very difficult. Until you realize it and let go of it, then it's no big deal dealing with gossip. You've done it. You've mastered it. But initially, it's very difficult for a lot of people. Sometimes it's situations that are very difficult for us. And those are the ones that's where we have the most difficulty in applying the Dhamma. But as we do it, it becomes much more easier. I don't know too many people that have gone through the book and just said, this is it, I got it. A few people have. But most people say exactly that. The reason why we're doing this at least once a year is it takes that repetition, coming back to it, keeping reintegrating these ideas into our lives, that it makes sense and that we have breakthroughs. Becky and Jen, you talked about kind of the both ends of the spectrum pretty well. You're just beginning and you're starting to see how to apply it, and you've applied it and you've had the benefit of it. You know, it's good. Another benefit of the Sangha, that we're able to be with each other in a way where some of us have developed it and some of us can answer the questions for those that are developing it. Mm-hmm. It works. That's the idea of a Sangha. So, thank you. Thomas, good to see you this morning. How have you been? Good.
So I'll start out with right speech, and be truthful, I actually didn't do the reading. I've been struggling with my meditation, but this week I actually did meditate twice daily.
Good for you.
It's a good start. I have read, you know, a lot of your book in the past, but I haven't read it recently, so it's not fresh in my mind. But as far as right speech, I would say I've always been one not to think before I speak. I think I speak with emotion or whatever is going on. And when I have a more concentrated mind, when I'm meditating more, you know, it's amazing how it just kind of guides my thoughts and actions without me even being mindful at the moment, or I catch it at the time. So I have been thinking a little bit more this week before I speak, and recognizing that my thoughts are rooted in, you know, my ego gets involved in a lot of my thoughts. And, you know, in my mind for my whole life, I'm thinking I'm this benevolent person. I've always had good intention. I've never said anything intentionally bad towards anyone. And, you know, it's amazing how that ego kind of distorts that, I think. And so I guess that's something I'm just trying to be more mindful of. Trying to think about what I'm saying and really understand what those thoughts are about, and you know how it's going to be, how it's going to come across, I guess. But being, you know, dealing with truth and how I speak too,
yeah.
And understanding the truth. You have to first understand what the truth is, and that's the hard part for me too. I've always had a hard time figuring out what's truly going on in my head. There's so many things going on at once, and
yeah.
What's the truth of what I'm thinking and feeling? And so, you know, as far as right speech, that's where I'm at with that. And right livelihood, I never really had a right livelihood, so I'm trying to really focus on that. And that really is about, I think, the people, and I think it was mentioned before, about the people the company you're with.
Yeah.
And that also affects your right speech and your right actions.
Yep.
Because if the norm is to gossip and to, you know, not have right, you know, even right thinking, you think you're being benevolent, you think you're doing the right things, and you're really not, you know. And so that's been something I've been working on a lot recently, is the right livelihood. And, you know, it is difficult because I start to realize the people that I've been spending my time with, good relationships, or you know, we're good people trying to do the right things, and you know, in our minds we are, but you know, those relationships may have to change. So, and right action, I thought on that too much. I guess I'm here, maybe that's the right action.
It is
my meditation,
yeah,
so
it's right action, right effort.
And then, you know, I intend to do the reading, I just you know, have up to this point.
Okay, good for you, and thank you for your honesty. And,
yeah.
But, and also, you're describing perfectly how you begin to integrate this practice. You're mindful of your right speech. You realize that there's aspects of it that need to change. And you see that without beating yourself up.
Yeah.
It's just something that has to change. And how do you do it? You deepen your concentration, and you have a framework for that change, the Eightfold Path. So I'm just glad you're here, and you're describing, developing it perfect. So good for you. Keep it up. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. Thank you. Well, I have to say I'm glad I started coming to this Sangha about a year ago or so before I started reading the book, because it's helpful. You know, all the stuff I've slowly been picking up on is helpful in terms of understanding. So that's a good thing. I was thinking about what Jen said about speech. I think for me, it's like I can read the book and kind of get some of it, but it's the integration, the applying it that's difficult for me, and I'm not recognizing the speech until after the fact, usually, still. You know, it's like, or the actions, or whatever it is, it's like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that, or I think I talked about this last week. So, you know, that's the ongoing struggle, that the insight is a lot of times after the fact, or have the insight, I'm starting to have the insight today in my meditation, I felt like I got some insight, but then I'm not
process, just like everything else, and it's a practice, it's based on practice, and, you know, so I'm trying to integrate things. I'm all about integration, so that's a good word for me, and acceptance is a good word for me, and accepting, you know, I heard that today, too, accepting the action of others in your life, and that you can't control them, and that, you know, sitting in the silence, it's good. It's good for me to do at work. It's good for me to do at home. So I'll practice that more too. So thanks.
Thank you. And again, you're describing how to integrate this perfectly. First, you have to have an awareness of it, even if it's after the fact. That's a lot better than not having the awareness at all, or to go to justification. Mm-hmm. You know that, you know, I'm right in being mean in my speech because so and so. You recognize it, and then you can abandon it. You first have to, you have to know where you are. You can, going back to Arnold Patton, that saying that stuck with me all these years, if you're in New York and you want to go to Chicago but you believe you're in Los Angeles, you can't get there. It's impossible. There's no way. Same thing with this. You can't change anything unless you know what you have to change. You know, that aspect, I think you used the word, it's disappointing to recognize that. That is part of the first noble truth. You know, the disappointing aspects of our own behavior is part of the disappointing aspects of life. We're part of that. Our experience prior to awakening, prior to full human maturity, is a contributing factor to dukkha. You know, and it's important to recognize that. That's exactly what you're doing. We're not separate from the first noble truth, and other people aren't separate from the first noble truth. The first noble truth is a noble truth because it covers it all. Covers everything that's going on. And what our individual contributions to that is what we begin to recognize when we're able to recognize our own craving and clinging. So, thank you. Mary, good to see you today. How are you?
Pretty good. I mean, as far as right speech goes, I find myself thinking about it and catching myself and, you know, trying not to take the bait, so to speak. When someone's trying, you know, kind of spoiling for a fight over whatever subject, you know, something on the internet, whatever, and I try not to take the bait. I find with the political situation, I get a little bit confused over what is and isn't right action, because I find myself wanting to undermine a lot of what's going on in Washington. Mm-hmm. Is that right action? I don't know, because I am trying to undermine. As far as supporting causes, you know, that are according to my viewpoint, but there are other viewpoints, so it gets a little muddled.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it does. And as we deepen our development of the Eightfold Path and use that to frame even our engagement or our cause making. Then that becomes more well focused. But also to understand, protest is part of this country, and I hope it never goes away. I'm concerned that it might, in a way that it'll even be looked down on, because there's a difference between speaking your voice than insisting that your voice get heard. And there's too much of insisting that a voice get heard rather than a peaceful protest. And it does, it gets pretty muddled, you know, what's right, what's wrong. What's most important is to develop an understanding of the true nature of the world, and then we can understand what we can truly, the differences we can truly make in the world. So even the American political process, which is probably the most advanced in the world, is an aspect of the first noble truth. There's a lot of disappointment, a lot of unsatisfactory experiences. It's just part of the nature of the world. It's not because of one individual. It's not because of one party. It's not because of one anything. It's part of the nature of the world. What can I do about it? I can look at my own craving and clinging and not insist that things be different than they are. But also remember that a lot of people feel that if I accept things as they are, I'm saying that that's how I want them to be. That's the difference between acceptance and approval. We're living in very, very unsettled times. And it's not just because of one human being, and it's not just because of one party or another. It's the nature of the world that we live in right now. What can I do about it? The most important thing I think I can do is to maintain as peaceful a mind as I possibly can. That's just... The conflicts in the world today are exactly the same as they were in the Buddha's time. The only thing that's different is this is a global view. That's all. There was an awful lot of violence and conflicts. There was always battles going on between different kingdoms, meaning different governments. And every government feels like they're the right one, and everybody's view is the right view. It's always going to be like that. And the Buddha looked up and saw it. He says, "It's first noble truth. What can I do about it? I can teach people how to develop a peaceful and calm mind. The rest of it's always going to be there. It'd be great if there was no conflict in the world, but the only conflict I can deal with is a conflict in my own mind. So thank you so much for saying it. It's a difficult time. There's not a degree in human history that we really need meditation now, but boy, we really need meditation now, don't we? Lauren, it's good to see you. Thank you, Mary.
Good to be here. Just to start that, I can't tell you how many aha moments I've had sitting here listening to everybody. It's just been great.
Me too.
Right speech. I am more thoughtful and more conscious of right speech, and it's happening now before I start speaking, which is good. So I think I'm developing that skill of being in right speech, verbally being in right speech. So I hope I'm developing that. I question myself whether I hold right speech in my own head myself. I think that's a harder task. To keep right speech toward yourself and to monitor your ego in your head, in your thinking, in any daily activity. It can creep up at any time, brushing your teeth or something. That's speaking about craving, clinging, and aversion. I've spoken recently about aversion, and Mary just mentioned the word muddled. That's very appropriate for what I'm trying to say. Is that when I catch myself doing an act that I'm avoiding something else, I'm not always clear what I'm avoiding. Although Jen speaks of articulating it. I feel it. It's a feeling with me. It's not a conscious thought. Jen can sort of speak very clearly that way. With me, I can just feel that I'm avoiding something, but I don't know what it is, so I'm doing something else to avoid something. And then I think, hold on. This is what, So how do I not go on to the avoiding behavior when I don't know what I'm avoiding? And to work out what I'm avoiding, it seems like another thought. Not that I have been able to feel or see that there's aversion happening. So I'll keep on this thought, which would be denying my aversion, which is hoping where I'm going, I hope. So how, as I say, Mary said model, I'll just go in one. You can overthink things.
Yep.
And I'm giving, like, this is aversion, but so if we go back to where I was, I'm avoiding the aversion. That's another one.
I'll stay
with Mary's words.
Well, you answered your question. When you start getting too analytical about it, you go down another road that leads nowhere. Aversion is aversion. Whether that your aversive thoughts are leading to other aversive thoughts, or whether you're concerned that they are, is just a skillful recognition. Of course they are. The whole point of distraction is to stay distracted. An aspect of ignorance is to ignore something. In fact, you have to have the intention to ignore it to remain ignorant. And that's another way of maintaining our ignorance, by continually holding the carrot in front of, we're holding the stick and the carrot to ourselves. We keep chasing something that we'll never get. Recognize there's aversion, period. It's not different levels of aversion. And also remember, aversion is just another side of the same coin of craving or desire. You know, aversion is the intense craving that something not take place, or that I don't experience something. It's still craving. And it's still rooted in a lack of understanding of the true nature of the world, you know, meaning the three marks of existence. So you also said something that I wanted to bring up when Jen started talking about it too. And a very subtle aspect of right speech that we usually don't even recognize until we start looking at it is self-talk. In fact, that's probably the most important aspect of right speech to look at, the things that we say to ourselves. One of the ways to recognize that, and many people do when they first start meditating, is realizing that distraction that comes up from our own thoughts is self-talk. And it's usually directed at ourselves. What I need, what I want, what I'm doing wrong, what I hope to do right. Why can't I meditate better? Lisa, you touched on it too, that you're not able to clear your mind. There's a subtlety there that has an aversion against clearing your mind. But even clearing, the idea of to clear your mind is not something that we're chasing in meditation anyway. It's just to recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts. Another interesting thing that's developed today is we're really talking about some subtle levels of developing a Dhamma, aren't we? You know, it's not just this surface. As we start developing it, it becomes very subtle, but the implications then can create their own type of aversion when we start realizing where we're going, letting go of all self-referential views. What's left when I don't have any self-referential views? I have no point of reference for the self. Like foam on the ocean, it's gone. What's left? Like Jen described, what's left? What was left when Siddhartha let go of all self-referential views? Lasting peace and happiness. Which is what we're all after. The Buddha arrived at how to develop exactly what he was looking for. When he set out on his search, he wasn't trying to answer the great questions of mankind. In fact, he talked about that. That wasn't it. He wanted to understand the nature of suffering and was there a way to bring it to cessation. That depicts that. When we sit on our cushions, we're an example of that. Except what's going on in our minds. But lasting peace and happiness. That's what everybody wants, isn't it? We just don't know how to get there. Why? Because of conditioned thinking. Because we have a way of looking at the world that's rooted in ignorance. Not that we're ignorant, it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths, meaning it's ignorant of the true nature of the world. There is dukkha, there is suffering in the world. There's nothing we can do to change that. But what we can change is our own individual contributions to that. So, what a great class. We've gone on a little bit long, and I actually have an appointment at 10:30, so I'll just introduce the concentration factors, but you'll be studying it. So this week we'll study right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation, known as the concentration factors. Right effort is the effort that we put in on our meditation cushions. It's just kind of a reminder that, hey, you got to meditate. That's part of the effort in developing this Dhamma. And then the other aspect of right effort is the effort that we talk about in every class, what the book is about, is developing an understanding of the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. That's your right effort. when the Buddha describes right effort, he describes it basically that way, and then he says that right effort is an effort that leads to awakening. This is one's, the Buddha's interpreted from the Pali, this is one's right effort. Doing what we need to do to develop the Dhamma. That makes sense, isn't it? Again, very practical. Right mindfulness, and again, using the words right, you could use the word skillful or unskillful, appropriate or inappropriate, but right mindfulness implies that there's such a thing as wrong mindfulness. And this really gets to another one of the hearts of the matter. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. We can do that with anything. I used to use an example of Dr. Oppenheimer, who developed the atomic bomb. By the way, a couple years after that, he said, this is one of the worst things I could imagine ever doing. He wasn't proud of it. But it took an incredible amount of mindfulness, the ability to hold in mind certain principles that allowed him to develop that technology. And there's still people that will argue, well, it was a good thing because it saved a lot of lives when we dropped the, you know, I don't want to get into that discussion. But the point is that that great, well-concentrated mind led to millions and millions of people getting blown up, and it's still a threat in the world today. And again, there's going to be somebody who say, well, look about nuclear energy. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is just because we can hold something in mind doesn't mean that it's a good skill to have. We need to hold in mind what is most skillful to hold in mind. Another example that I use is from my own experience. I'm a recovered drug addict and alcoholic. There was a long time in my life that the only thing I could be mindful of was where am I getting my next drink or drug. That's an aspect of mindfulness. It's an aspect of mindfulness that almost killed me, and it's killed a lot of people in the world. It still is. That's an aspect of mindfulness. We can hold in mind anything. Right mindfulness inclines our mind towards what we should hold in mind. And what is that? It's the principles of the Eightfold Path. When the Buddha described right mindfulness, I said it earlier today, he described it this way. When engaged in wrong view, be mindful of that and enter and remain in right view. When engaged in wrong intention, be mindful of that and enter and remain in right intention, etc., going through the Eightfold Path. And then the other application of mindfulness that the Buddha taught was the four foundations of mindfulness that we engage in meditation. We're mindful of our breath in the body. We're mindful that feelings will arise. Sometimes those feelings drive thoughts. Sometimes it's thoughts that drive feelings. And that fourth foundation of mindfulness that I remind everyone of at the end of meditation, to notice the quality of your mind, be at peace with your mind. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. To simply recognize the quality of your mind that has developed from either the dispassionate mindfulness of feelings and thoughts or the reaction to feelings and thoughts. And if we're reacting to our feelings and our thoughts, we're going to have a less than peaceful quality of mind. And if we're simply maintaining a dispassionate observance of our feelings and our thoughts, then our minds will be at peace. Those are the four foundations of mindfulness. Look at the words that are used. This was taught in the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta on being mindful of, the sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness. These are the foundations of maintaining mindfulness, maintaining what we should hold in mind. The last factor of the concentration factors and the last factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation. So there's all different types of meditation in the world today, just like there was during the Buddha's time. During the Buddha's search for enlightenment, he studied with two of the most foremost meditation teachers of his time. He mastered those meditation techniques very quickly, and he abandoned them just as quickly because he recognized they weren't leading to the goal. And so today we have a nearly infinite number of different things that are called meditation. And some of them can be accurately described as meditation. Some of them have really nothing to do with meditation. They're more contemplation. But if meditation, we talked earlier about this today too, the meditation method that is part of the Eightfold Path is there to develop deep concentration so that we can hold in mind the rest of the factors of the Eightfold Path, so we can recognize when we're engaged in wrong speech or wrong action or wrong livelihood and do something about it. So right meditation is that last factor of the Eightfold Path, the last factor of the concentration factors, and it's there to deepen concentration. And the only meditation method that the Buddha ever taught for 45 years is what we use here today, Shamatha Vipassana meditation. So you'll study that this week, and we'll talk about it next week, and then I'll introduce the three marks of existence next week. We'll get into that. So, any questions about this week's study or this week's class? What a great class. Thank you. Well, we'll finish with metta, the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none despise, deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.